Hello, if you just joined us, you're watching Stockwatch. Tackling your questions in studio this evening, Jean-Pierre Fester from Fairtree Capital and Sanaya from Sasfin. Don't forget to send through your questions via SMS 41392, email stockwatch@bdtv.co.za, or tweet us at BusinessDayTV using hashtag Stockwatch. Gents, evening. Thanks for joining us on the line. Not much news today except peace in North Korea. Perhaps maybe we can park that. Jean-Pierre, U.S. headline inflation 2.8% in May, expected, is the highest level in 6 years. The 10-year bond kind of stayed at its 2.9 and some change. What it does tell us is inflation edging up, Fed raising rates. I mean, this is how it's going to play out.
Yes, look, I'm not an economist.
Sure.
Not a fixed income investor either. So I keep my comments on macroeconomics very short. So I'll just say that it seems like the U.S. economy is improving, and at the same time, it seems like inflation is ticking up, but mildly so. So we seem to be in that Goldilocks period, not too hot, not too cold, rates aren't rising too quickly or too slowly, and that's great for equities. As we've seen, the S&P especially do so well the last year to two and a half a bit. It's great markets for equities.
It has been a good driver. We've certainly seen the numbers, and a lot of folks have said it got ahead of itself. And we can debate valuations, but there certainly is an underpinning in the U.S. economy to say all-time highs aren't the craziest thing, or in this case, almost all-time highs aren't the craziest thing.
Yeah, listen, I mean, I think I would have expected the U.S. 10-year bond yield to be at least above 3% by now. But I suppose, you know, that geopolitical issues around the world are keeping it at a relatively strong level. You know, on the equity side, still very much a tech story this year. You know, the Nasdaq is up, what, almost 10%, maybe slightly over. The rest of the S&P itself is lingering.
Yeah.
So similar story to what we had last year. But of course, I mean, we had serious growth in the last 6 months last year. So hopefully we experience the same thing, especially here.
We would like to have it here because we didn't get that growth much last year. One set of results out, store ages, as they pronounce it, very different in that it's a storage facility rather than typical property. Not a bad set of numbers for what they're doing. In a sense, almost a tough economy might help them because people are perhaps downsizing, perhaps need some space, and, well, they've got their warehouses.
Exactly. I actually own some in some of the local funds that I manage. Nice yield, and the long-term growth seems to be quite strong because of that. People downscaling, more stuff but less space, so they need to go and rent one of these units. That's on average about 2 years that the person
which I thought was quite
rents.
Chunky. Mm.
Yes, so people always say, oh, it'll just be a month or two. And when they see all of a sudden they've used the units for 2 years. And that's what you want. You want high utilization. You can see in terms of their properties, they give the utilization rates of different properties. And in that, you can see there's still some scope to improve that. They expanded into the UK earlier this year. That seems to be going well. Hopefully, we'll get some synergies there. They mentioned they are looking at integrating systems and getting some cost savings out of the UK operation. Some related party transactions with management, which I think, given recently what has happened with other companies, people also take a very close look at that, but it seems to be all above board.
That's
and one
the
can
Bryanston.
Understand. Yes, a Bryanston is one of them, for instance, where the management would fund the development of a property, and only when it's ready to be effectively let out and to be operational, they would on-sell it to the company itself. But if you think about it, you are buying into an entity for yield. So it makes sense that you don't want the company itself to go through a yield, a J-curve, as long as it's a fair price that the company buys the completed units from the management team. And they say there are checks and balances to do that. So with that given, I quite like the story and the company.
We can run some fair prices on that as well. We can look at their Bryanston unit and work out cost per meter, revenue, etc. We can go and pick the one down here just south of the M2 and or on the M3 and we can get a fair sense ourselves. I ran the numbers and I thought, because I'm with you, related party transactions, don't like them. Ran the numbers, seemed like a right deal.
Exactly. And great management team, entrepreneurial, two brothers. So I like the business and the management team.
Is it a stock you've had a look at? As I said, very different. And globally, it's actually a good asset class. And I know a lot of folks who run global property company stocks, funds like them. Mm-hmm. Locally, it really is a one-off as opposed to our usual.
I think very early, still early in the local scene, but it does speak to, you know, urbanization, people moving into cities, yeah, not being able to buy big houses any longer, so they can make do with smaller houses. And then, you know, there's always stuff that you accumulate, which, you know, you're going to have to store during summer or winter. So it does have a nice sort of story, very big in the U.S. In fact, one of the biggest U.S. property companies is Public Storage, which does exactly the same thing. I thought the results were very good. Was it 97 cents worth of distributable earnings, yeah, somewhere around, yeah, there? On a 13 Rand share price, 10% growth. I mean, as far as property companies go, this wasn't too bad at all. Except, of course, I think the shift now is focused to the UK. I think they've got a lot more property now in the UK. Obviously, they're still growing, so they'll scale up in South Africa as well. But I think a nice one to hold. I'm not sure on the liquidity. We don't hold it, you know, we got to buy across 5,000 private clients. So, you know, liquidity becomes very important for us. But something to watch.
Yeah, it's one when it popped up, and to the folks who told me to buy it, I didn't. I apologize. I was nervous. I wanted to see it find its feet, and now it has its feet. Question coming through around Dis-Chem. Was up at almost $40 when its results came out. Been under pressure. At what point does it become an attractive proposition?
Listen, Dis-Chem, I think the results themselves weren't too bad on, sure, the top line. And I think people were expecting, well, when you're on a 35 PE, you must grow at 35% a year, right?
Or be clicks. It doesn't matter.
Exactly. And I think what happened was, I think earnings growth disappointed. But it was justified because they're making a big investment in their wholesale sort of logistics infrastructure. And I think because the stock is held perhaps by a lot of foreigners, you know, they just look at headline numbers. And if the headline numbers don't add up, I mean, they just sell. Where's it now? 27?
27, some change.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you're a long-term investor, it's certainly coming to territory that I think is quite attractive.
Jean-Pierre, it was 35, 38 PE, same as Clicks, but it's not Clicks. It aspires to be Clicks. Does it start to get attractive at these levels?
it probably does, but one needs to make a mind shift. For me, there are the two most difficult decisions that I make as a portfolio manager is usually, firstly, when a company's shares seem extremely cheap, but they're not good quality, to stay, mm-hmm, away. And secondly, if a company is very high quality, to be willing to pay higher than what you otherwise would. And this falls into that second category. So given the very long-term, very high average growth you would expect, given the size of the company and the size of the addressable market, I think one can pay up for the company. So I think the current price, on a nearer-term view, looks expensive, but it's one of them that you can open your eyes and 10 years down the line, it could be 7 times the size, which means a reasonable return in terms of a compound annual return rate, and therefore paying up for something that's high quality, long-term high quality, is not a bad decision. So yes, it probably is in good territory at the moment.
Okay, Abdul's asking around Vodacom, fair value entry point for Vodacom. Why such a pounding after the announcement of the BEE? And that's because it's dilutory. More shares come out, you're getting your shares now worth a little bit less per share. Your take on Vodacom at these levels in this environment?
Yeah, they try to limit the dilution by effectively consolidating the BE vehicle back in, which, yes, means you deduct the shares because they become treasury shares. But if you think about it, the dilution to the dividend is much more, because just because you own the vehicle doesn't mean you deduct the shares when you pay the dividend. The dividend still flows out. So the dilution is more than what you actually see if you look at the HEPS dilution. And that is why the shares dropped quite a bit. At the moment, I think it's relatively fair value. It's a great cash generator. We're still waiting for some spectrum to be released, which will help them to give more bandwidth to their addressable market and generate more money from selling data. And until that happens, that constrains them. So it's okay. It's in that, unfortunately, fair value range.
not Goldilocks. Goldilocks is more positive. The issue, I mean, Vodacom doesn't have the MTN challenges, Iran, yeah, Turkey, Nigeria, etc., which makes them a lot more cash flush. They've got less growth prospects. Your take on Vodacom?
I think, you know, when you go through the numbers on this BEE deal, the results we've looked at, you know, says I think 17% earnings dilution in the first year. I think it goes to 7%. And the truth is, it's not growing at 15% and 20% a year, you know, to endure that sort of dilution. And I mean, it's always been a dividend play, and now with the dilution, the dividend, I think a lot of investors beginning to say, hey, listen, you know, let's see how this thing plays out. The Safaricom deal, which was supposed to, boost Vodacom's geographical diversity, of course, hasn't really come through. We haven't really seen those numbers coming through yet. So I think maybe, you know, the patience of investors are being tested a little bit. And I think the fact that this BE deal was done at group level, you know, the previous deal was actually done at Vodacom SA level.
Yes.
I also thought was a bit strange, because I don't think there would have been any pressure on them to change that existing deal. They could have increased the size of it. But I suppose, you know, like MTN and Sasol, everybody wants to at least give BE investors exposure to group. And you know, even though these are multinational companies.
Yeah, fair point. Now, the group point is important. Question coming through around Discovery, around 180 towards the end of last year, come back into the mid-140s now. They got a bank coming, crowded space. Your take on Discovery?
I think, you know, if you look at the GDP number, a lot of foreign investors looking at South Africa, obviously coming into 2018 was a good news story across the board.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the reality of those GDP numbers setting in, as you say, you know, of course, Discovery is going to have a very niche banking operation, but still getting more and more crowded with Bank Zero and Time Digital. I mean, you know, you can't walk out of the house today without tripping over a few new banks.
New banks. And, of course, Investec moving into insurance.
Yes.
And
so I think a little bit of a crowded space in an economy that's not really growing, stagnating, in fact, and in a policy environment that's, not very comforting. So, you know, on a heady valuation that Discovery was, and even though it's a fantastic growth company, we have it in a lot of portfolios, I think maybe some people just taking off a little bit off the table.
Your take on it?
Yeah, look, I said a few minutes ago that one of the most often mistakes that a person makes is buying something or not buying something that's high quality because it looks too expensive. Now, this is what can happen in the interim. You buy Discovery at 180, next thing you know, it's 145. But if you did buy it saying that it's a very high quality company with a higher than average growth rate over the long term, you should hold it over the long term. And then a retracement of 30%.
This is only about 15% down.
Exactly. So, it could get to 30, but but that shouldn't scare you out of a good share if you had the long term in mind. There are some question marks regarding their aggressive assumptions. If you look at the embedded value,
sure.
But the health administration business is such a strong cash generator that speaks to a lot of the other businesses who are absorbing cash, and for the investment case, then balances it out because you know you've got the big cash generator to help those other businesses that absorb cash at the moment. So, great quality company, was too expensive. Now, again, I would say close to fair value. It's, you know, if we go back 6 months ago, a lot of these domestic shares were expensive.
Mm.
But at the moment, seeing that they've all come down 15, 20, 25%, some of the retailers, I see for a lot of shares, unfortunately, I'm sitting on the fence. I'm in fair value territory.
Yeah, fair value territory. And to your point, you bought it for the long term. You bought quality. The price fluctuation, don't stress it so much. Certainly don't lose sleep about it. Time for a quick break. Keep sending through your questions via SMS 41392. Email stockwatch@businessday.tv. Welcome back. Let's take a quick look at how global markets are doing. So we're green, mostly green in the US. S&P 500 up a smidgen, the Nasdaq up 0.5%, and the Dow Jones down a handful of points into the red. Across in Europe, a mostly red day. FTSE 100 out of London, almost 0.5% down. The CAC around 40 in France, down almost 0.4%. And the DAX in Frankfurt, down a fraction of a couple of points, essentially flat there. Gents, questions coming through. Foresight, I don't know, Jean-Pierre, you probably know not even a little about it.
Sure.
It listed sometime last year. They've got lots of buzzwords around it, and the stock's just been falling.
That's probably why I don't know much.
Yeah, I'm with you. I wrote about
don't
it.
They do like big data analytics and
there we go,
fantastic
we go.
Stuff like that, you know.
Buzzwords.
And no one else does it.
So my argument was...
I'm not sure how you monetize that sort of thing, but I'm...
my view was too many buzzwords. just to your point around quality. Quality doesn't need buzzwords. So, okay, let's go on to ShopRite. Pulled back also a bit from its highs again. Quality company in the food retail space. One of those fair values, or
I'm going to sound like a broken record, Simon. I would say that I think in ShopRite's case, it could retrace a bit more. I think it's in fair value, but it's at the upper end of fair value. If you look at inflation, okay, we have had the rand all of a sudden weaken, sure. So that is good from an inflation point of view if you're a retailer, but it's bad for the volume of goods because the consumer will be under pressure, especially with fuel prices going up. If you expect them to go up, looking at the rand price of a barrel of oil at the moment, that's quite scary for the next month. So I do think that for a lot of food retailers, the problem a month ago was lack of inflation. Now that's not a problem anymore, but the knock-on effect is more pressure on the consumer because of inflation, especially fuel inflation, and that is also not great. So I would rather pay a lower price for the food retailers.
Yeah, wait a bit forward. Certainly ShopRite, I mean, operating margins knocking out the park, distribution centers, absolutely. They've been all over Pick and Pay's tail for 15 years.
I think this is an exemplary example of what we're talking about now, a quality business. And I think you always buy it on weakness. The only concern for me around ShopRite is obviously Christo Visser. You know, although he's probably not as involved in ShopRite, but still has a lot of shares, and there may be a little bit of a share overhang.
Yeah, and he might need to bail those to fund...
pay off his debts at Steinhoff. That's the only thing that concerns me, is the extent to which, you know, he may be under pressure to sell shares. And I think towards the end of, was it the beginning of this year, he had to sell some shares, and, you know, that pushed the share price to close to 200 if it didn't come slightly below that. My view is you look at those sort of opportunities to pick up some of these.
Yeah, and I remember how close it was to Steinhoff taking my ShopRite shares out of my hands. Fortunately, it never got to a vote because I would have lost the vote. Coronation. Mike says, bought 3 months ago. Must I hold or sell at first loss, best loss? Again, it's more a trader talk than an investor talk. Coronation.
Listen, Coronation is one of those shares that's going to be geared to what's happening in the stock market. First point. The second point is if you look at the results that came out, AUM, asset under management was actually down, which means a base on which they calculate their fees had actually shrunk a little bit. They lost some institutional money, which agreed is at a lower pricing than retail money. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for a business like Coronation, with a reasonably sized fixed cost basis, you know, what you need to buy it when the stock market's actually doing quite well. Still a good dividend payer, though. And depending on how long you want to hold it for and what's your view on the market, may take some time to get back to that 80-90 rand level, I think.
They brought some extra costs into the base. They're doing the follow the sun. They're going to become a 24/7 operation because they're suddenly doing global, etc. That might not pay off in the very short term, bring some costs into the base, but they're certainly wanting to become a global player out of an EM space.
Yes, and I like that ambition. I think as South Africans, quite often, unfortunately, in the past, we've had a bit of an insular view, and when South African companies do go offshore, they rather buy something, keep the management team there, keep it at arm's length, and then it doesn't work that well. So I like the idea of Coronation saying, we've got a very strong position in South Africa, our formula works, we've got a very good long-term track record, let's try and leverage this for a global edge.
Do it ourselves.
Exactly, and they've sort of done it in the Global Emerging Markets franchise, and they're trying to do this now with the Global Equity franchise, which is more developed markets. And if they get that right, there's a lot of upside. It's a huge market out there. So it's early days. There's always a chance it mightn't be successful, but it's not a big investment to make. You've already got the people. You employ a few extra analysts. You show them the Coronation way, and hopefully they'll generate some alpha. So I like it, and I think at 60 Rand, I see a lot of value in Coronation.
Yeah, and nice leverageability there in that sense. As you say, a few people and good salaries, but you know, could double their AUM and make a big difference. Sasol, last week, Wayne McCurry was reminding me two things are going to happen with Sasol now. Their ethane cracker plant, their whole Louisiana is going to finally stop costing money because they'll finish building it. And we can debate whether they overpaid for it, but they've paid for it. And then it'll start bringing some revenue in. Is it attractive notwithstanding its run on the weaker rand and stronger oil?
Yes, firstly, that extra revenue is dollar revenue.
Yes.
So with the rand where it is at the moment, if you asked me a month ago, I would have said fair value again. If you ask me now, below 500 rand, I see value in Sasol. It's extremely sensitive to the rand dollar, and the oil price in dollar terms has been moving up in the last 6 months. So if you have Louisiana coming on stream, plus the rand at these weak levels, plus the oil price at strong levels, plus the differential between the input and the output, the crack, as they call it, of the ethane cracker, I think Sasol will do very well over the next few years.
Your take on Sasol?
It's always been, historically a rand oil price play. So what we've seen is the oil price kick up recently, the rand weaken, and that's filtered into the share price. But of course, this ethylene plant, now this ethane cracker, which basically, produces down the line the feedstock for plastics. And the plastic story globally, is still a very good one with urbanization and, increasing population and industrialization. The intensity of use of plastic is actually increasing. And Sasol's, I think, in the perfect place. The feedstock prices are very low historically thanks to fracking, and probably going to stay that way. And they'll earn that margin between the crack spread that John Pierre was talking about. So I think, the numbers that we've looked at, spot earnings close to about 57 rand a share, which puts it on a nine. And then when the profits from the ethane cracker come through, in 2020, 2021, you're looking at close to 78 rand a share. So, very hard to work on predictions and forecasts and things, but hard to deny the that those numbers are very good for it.
And predicting the rand short term is a mug's game, but predicting the rand long term, 5-10 years out, not because of politics, just because of currencies, it will be weaker.
Yeah.
So let's go to Steinhoff Retail Africa, which has got, unfortunately, two parts to the story. And the one part is the business and their operations, and the other part is the chaos happening in boardrooms.
Yes, and the name change and disassociation from Steinhoff. So already today they said the company secretary will move from Steinhoff Services to Pepkor, and very soon I'm sure we'll have a name change of Steinhoff Africa Retail to Pepkor. And basically that's what the business is. The only tricky thing is where Chris de Visa used to hold a big chunk of the shares directly and then via Bright and then via Steinhoff, now very soon there might be a dismemberment of the intermediary. And what does that mean? Who effectively is going to end up owning Pepkor? Will it be the banks that currently hold the debt in Steinhoff?
And it's a big slice. It's 70-odd%.
Yes. So there's some very interesting questions and very interesting permutations how this can play out. But as a business itself, Pepkor's got a very strong track record. There are a few key questions, though. The one is the impact that Campion Capital through Capfin had on stimulating top-line sales through giving loans in the Pepkor group and through the JD Group book also facilitating the furniture sales. And then we had the issue regarding the management incentive scheme, which I'm actually closer to management's point of view, where it was a mistake by Steinhoff to not change a scheme that previously was in the Bright structure linked to Bright shares, then in the Steinhoff structure linked to Steinhoff shares, to then link it to Star shares when Star listed.
Which would make all the sense in the world.
Yes, so that was the big error. And I can sort of understand why they need to fix that now, and it does cost something in terms of shareholders putting some money in for that incentive scheme. But given what the management have done over the long term of creating value, I don't begrudge it that we make sure that they aren't insolvent tomorrow.
That 500 million is truthfully existing shareholders' problem. If I buy it today, it's not my problem.
Yeah, it's probably already discounted in the share
price.
Hopefully you didn't buy yesterday.
No. Depends when you buy. Another stock with another potential overhang, though.
Yeah, I think...
Market seems to be pricing it.
Let's not forget the litigation with the Tekkitown guys. There's just so many different fronts that have to be defended here, simultaneously. And it's going to be a while before I think the real money long-term investors are going to say, right, listen, we like the business, now we're prepared to invest. And I think that's why you're seeing the level of volatility that we've been seeing. Listed at 20 Rand.
Yeah.
I think it went as high as 26, 27 Rand. I'm not sure the number. Pull back now. Is it the right time to get in? I'd wait for some of the bad news to subside a little bit.
And maybe pay slightly more for it, but get a slightly higher level of certainty in the process.
I think so.
Let's go to some stock picks. British American Tobacco pops up on my screens all the time, been under pressure. You're saying now's the time?
I think, you know, the reason it's been under pressure is generally interest rates have gone up, and it's sensitive to interest rates, being a so-called consumer staple.
If you're a smoker, it is.
I mean, the other reason is obviously Philip Morris, when they came out with their results. Remember, they run a competing business, Philip Morris International. These new generation products, not experiencing the level of growth that perhaps was anticipated by the market, sold off aggressively. British American now on a 5.5% dividend yield, still able to grow their top line in light of lower volumes, I think still represents a very compelling investment case.
Jean-Pierre, SoftBank, which probably best described as the Berkshire Hathaway of Japan in some senses.
Yes, or the Naspers of Japan, you could also say.
So
I don't know if you've ever heard of Masayoshi Son. He's one of the 100 most wealthy people in the world and the CEO and chairman of SoftBank Group. And SoftBank is similar to Naspers in that it owns roughly a third or just under 30% of Alibaba. It owns SoftBank, which is a big telecoms group in Japan. Mm-hmm. It owns Yahoo Japan. It owns Arm, the chip manufacturer, which it bought roughly a year ago. And it owns a big chunk of Sprint, the U.S., call it fourth largest mobile phone group. Now, tonight at 10 o'clock, we have the U.S. Hearing and pronouncement on the merger between Time Warner and AT&T. That will set the precedent for the expected merger between Sprint and T-Mobile,
which is number 3 and 4.
Yes, so hopefully if they get to, if the Time Warner one is allowed, hopefully the Sprint T-Mobile one will be allowed. That's very good for SoftBank because it takes a lot of the debt off their balance sheet, because they will then not they will only have a 27% stake and therefore not consolidate those numbers. So it sorts out the balance sheet. The SoftBank Vision Fund, which has $100 billion to invest in all kinds of new technology. They've got a stake in Uber, a stake in General Motors, a stake in all kinds of different things. It's a great entrepreneur. You're backing him. Big company trading at a 50% discount to the sum of the parts. So similar to now, special
electric. Okay, we'll a little bit more. And the code is 9984. Go figure that. The Japs are crazy. Thanks to our guests, Jean-Pierre Fester from Fairtree Capital going with SoftBank, and Nassim Nair from Sasfin going with British American Tobacco. Thank you for watching. Same place, same time tomorrow. Have a good evening. Let's go to some stock picks. British American Tobacco pops up on my screens all the time, been under pressure. You're saying now's the time?
I think, you know, the reason it's been under pressure is generally interest rates have gone up, and it's sensitive to interest rates, being a so-called consumer staple.
If you're a smoker, it is.
I mean, the other reason is obviously Philip Morris, when they came out with their results. Remember, they run a competing business, Philip Morris International. These new generation products, not experiencing the level of growth that perhaps was anticipated by the market, sold off aggressively. British American now on a 5.5% dividend yield, still able to grow their top line in light of lower volumes, I think still represents a very compelling investment case.
Jean-Pierre, SoftBank, which probably best described as the Berkshire Hathaway of Japan in some senses.
Yes, or the Naspers of Japan, you could also say.
So
I don't know if you've ever heard of Masayoshi Son. He's one of the 100 most wealthy people in the world and the CEO and chairman of SoftBank Group. And SoftBank is similar to Naspers in that it owns roughly a third or just under 30% of Alibaba. It owns SoftBank, which is a big telecoms group in Japan. Mm-hmm. It owns Yahoo Japan. It owns Arm, the chip manufacturer, which it bought roughly a year ago. And it owns a big chunk of Sprint, the U.S., call it fourth largest mobile phone group. Now, tonight at 10 o'clock, we have the U.S. Hearing and pronouncement on the merger between Time Warner and AT&T. That will set the precedent for the expected merger between Sprint and T-Mobile,
which is number 3 and 4.
Yes, so hopefully if they get to, if the Time Warner one is allowed, hopefully the Sprint T-Mobile one will be allowed. That's very good for SoftBank because it takes a lot of the debt off their balance sheet. because they will then not, they will only have a 27% stake and therefore not consolidate those numbers. So it sorts out the balance sheet. The SoftBank Vision Fund, which has $100 billion to invest in all kinds of new technology. They've got a stake in Uber, a stake in General Motors, a stake in all kinds of different things. It's a great entrepreneur. You're backing him. Big company trading at a 50% discount to the sum of the parts. So similar to now Special Electric.
Okay, that a little bit more. And the code is 9984. Go figure that. The Japs are crazy. Thanks to our guests, Jean-Pierre Verster from Fairtree Capital going with SoftBank. And Naseem Nayar from Sasfin going with British American Tobacco. Thank you for watching. Same place, same time tomorrow. Have a good evening.